Welcome to the May 2010 podcast for Neurosurgical Focus. I'm Natalie Pinsham. The theme of this issue is military neurosurgery, past and present. Topic editor Paul Klimo of Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Ohio speaks with Colonel Rocco Armonda, the senior Army neurosurgeon at Walter Reed Army Medical Center in Washington, D.C. Colonel Armonda is the senior author of the lead article in the issue, which is entitled Early Decompressive Craniectomy for Severe Penetrating and Closed Head Injury During Wartime.
Well, good afternoon. Brian Ragel from the Oregon Health Sciences and myself, Paul Klimo from Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, are the guest editors for the May 2010 Neurosurgical Focus series entitled Military Neurosurgery, Past and Present. We have chosen to discuss the lead paper in our focus series, Early Decompressive Craniectomy for Severe Penetrating and Closed Head Injury During Wartime by Dr. Randy Bell and colleagues. This paper details one of the most, if not the most valuable lesson learned from the current conflicts in Iraq and Afghanistan, that being the rapid and aggressive application of decompressive craniectomy for penetrating and closed head injury. This afternoon, we have the pleasure of discussing the details of this paper and other aspects of today's U.S. military neurosurgery with the senior author of the paper, Colonel Rocco Armonda. Dr. Armonda is the senior Army neurosurgeon at Walter Reed Medical Center in Washington, D.C., and subspecializes in open and endovascular management of vascular neurosurgery. His more than 20 years of service, both stateside and abroad, places him at the forefront of the military's ability to manage traumatic battlefield brain injury. Dr. Armonda, it is indeed an honor to have you with us today.
Thank you very much, Paul.
Dr. Armonda, I would like to begin by first summarizing your paper. You and your colleagues retrospectively studied all patients with penetrating and closed head injuries suffered during combat operations in either Iraq or Afghanistan who subsequently received neurosurgical evaluation at either the National Naval Medical Center in Bethesda or the Walter Reed Medical Center in Washington, D.C. over a five-year period, that being from April of 2003 to October of 2008. You had 408 patients which met your study criteria, with 188 undergoing a decompressive craniectomy, the vast majority, 154 or 82%, for penetrating head injury. Although there was no difference in age or evacuation times between those who did and did not receive a decompressive craniectomy, there were significant differences in other outcomes. The decompressive craniectomy group had lower initial GCS and higher injury severity scores. In both groups, the mean Glasgow outcome scale scores at discharge, 6 months, and 1 to 2 years follow-up showed improvements, with the non-decompressive crani group having higher scores at each time period. And overall, 83% of those for whom follow-up data was available at 1 year, the GOS score was greater than 3. And so you concluded from your paper that decompressive craniectomy resulted in meaningful survival in many cases, and that this form of damage control neurosurgery facilitated transport of the wounded patient over long distances without direct neurosurgical supervision. So I suspect that almost all of the patients that had a decompressive crani had it done while they were in theater, meaning at the closest military medical facility to the battlefield that had neurosurgical capabilities. And so for Iraq, I suspect this would be Balad, and for Afghanistan, it would have been Bagram. My question for you was, there any soldiers that had decompressive operations done after they arrived stateside?
It is correct, Paul, that the majority of these patients had their decompressive surgery done in the combat theater. And this changed in terms of location depending upon the year. Initially, we were out in a combat support hospital out in the open desert for the first 5 months of the conflict during Operation Iraqi Freedom. And it was done at the 28 Combat Support Hospital by the 207th Neuro Team. And then after August of 2003, we then moved into the Ibn Sina Hospital in Baghdad. And the greatest number of decompressive craniectomies were actually done during that following year from 2004 until 2005. And if you'll remember, that was the period where there was the greatest number of combat casualties associated with Fallujah, both in the spring and then in the fall offensive. And that occurred at the Ebon Sina Hospital under the command of Lieutenant Colonel Jeff Poffenbarger and Rich Gullick. The next stage then was the movement of neurosurgery to Balad, where it was at a fixed air base, which afforded the ability to then rapidly medevac these patients in a strategic move out of theater on fixed-wing aircraft, so really minimize the amount of movement of these patients.
Mm-hmm.
But you're correct. Most of these operations were actually done very soon after their initial injury. The time period is anywhere from an hour to 2 hours after their initial injury, where these patients underwent rapid imaging and then a decompressive craniectomy in those patients who required it. There was a very small number of patients who came back from either Afghanistan or Iraq who had a delayed deterioration, having not had a decompressive craniectomy, who then underwent a decompressive craniectomy at either National Naval Medical Center or at Walter Reed Army Medical Center. These patients had a slightly different type of injury. In many cases, it was an injury that may have involved a secondary vascular insult, like a venous infarct or mm-hmm. delayed cerebral edema with much more severe swelling than appreciated on their initial injury images. Maybe far four, they had a subdural evacuated and then had delayed edema swelling, which then mandated the removal of the bone flap.
Okay.
In some rare cases, some of these patients actually had an abdominal compartment syndrome, and the abdominal compartment syndrome then transferred increased pressures to the brain, and they required a decompressive craniectomy. But over 90% of the decompressive craniectomies were done in Afghanistan or in Iraq at the closest level 3 facility that had a neurosurgeon.
When I read through your paper, it didn't seem so much that the paper was a comparison of battlefield management of head trauma, and by that I mean that your two groups, the decompressive crani group and the non-decompressive crani group, were really quite different. The patients who received a decompressive craniectomy had more severe injuries than the non-decompressive group. And I know that, at least in the civilian world, there's been some efforts to definitively prove the beneficial effects of a decompressive surgery for civilian trauma. But it seems to me that the remarkable neurologic results that you've achieved in this population in a battlefield, arguably that has a much worse prognosis for a number of reasons, for the mechanisms involved, for the degree of systemic injury, obviates the need for, you know, a randomized study. Do you think that with this paper, have you shown that decompressive craniectomy really does work and there really is no substitute for it? Do you think that your results will help promote the use of decompressive surgery in a civilian setting?
And that's really the pivotal issue here. And the credit for these outcomes go to the entire group of neurosurgeons who served far forward, the combat medics and the medevac officers who got the patients out from the fields of fire back to the level 3 facility, and then the whole core of individuals who helped in terms of the chain of care of getting these patients back to CONUS, back to the United States, into an ICU setting that had higher sophisticated monitoring and capabilities. So in terms of does this obviate the need for a randomized control study, that's very controversial. The battlefield is not a place to do a randomized controlled study. It's an environment where, in fact, you do the best you can with the equipment you have for the patient that you're in the care of. And for those patients who it was identified that the mechanism of their injury, early radiographic findings and or exam looked like that they were going to have significant swelling beyond maybe what you saw in the operating room, the decision was made to perform a hemicraniectomy. Realize a decompressive craniectomy is being applied here to patients, a large percentage of which have penetrating trauma.
Mm-hmm.
So this falls way outside the realm of what had been done in the civilian sector in terms of applying decompressive hemicraniectomy to trauma or to stroke patients.
Correct.
And it was done predominantly because what you face is a complex mechanism of injury which involves blast factors, blunt factors, secondary edema, penetrating fragments, and it's very hard to predict which patients are going to go on to have intractable cerebral edema shift, especially during a very prolonged medevac back. So the application of this was typically to the more severe injured patients, and there were a couple cases where, in retrospect, the operation should have been done perhaps earlier in some of the patients who a standard craniotomy was done,
mm-hmm.
and the bone flap should have been left out. And then there's a smaller number of patients in whom the operation was done, but the flap should have been larger, more on the basis of a 15-centimeter by 12-centimeter size, or it should have been a bifrontal decompression opposed to a unilateral decompression. So it's very hard to predict when you see these patients initially, especially those patients who maybe from the field it was reported that they initially talked, and then by the time you see them, they're comatose or having been medicated, intubated, you don't have much of an exam.
Mm-hmm.
So those patients who talk and deteriorate may be some of the worst patients that you see. It's not the standard civilian epidural hematoma that's very responsive to evacuation and placement of the flap. These patients, in fact, go on to have a progressive, almost delayed increase edema that's not just localized to where perhaps penetrating fragments were, but may involve the entire hemisphere, may involve both hemispheres. And it's very hard to predict what the course of their edema will be.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with you on that. Let me just extend the conversation to a similar topic. So obviously there are many differences between cranial injuries suffered by soldiers in the battlefield in Iraq and Afghanistan compared to civilian, obviously non-battlefield trauma. And if you could, for the listeners, briefly describe what are some of the unique issues military neurosurgeons in these deployed locations, what do they have to take into consideration when they're planning a decompressive craniectomy?
One of the more important things to consider in a military environment is that the individual that you're taking care of rarely has just an isolated head injury. Many times these individuals will have an associated extremity injury, will have had concomitant significant blood loss, may have been hypoxic or hypotensive in the field. In the desert environments, many of these patients are already dehydrated before they get injured, and that can exacerbate hypotension en route to care. So they're at much higher risk in terms of secondary injury and associated with multi-trauma. And the multi-trauma also elevates their injury severity score. So these are patients who have a much greater burden of injury when you compare to an individual who is in the civilian setting who has perhaps a pure blunt mechanism or isolated head injury.
Mm-hmm.
The other difference, and which makes this difficult to compare, is that with penetrating trauma, many of these patients have been protected and become patients because of the fact that they have body armor. So without the existence of body armor, many of these patients would have been killed in action, dead at the scene of impact.
Mm-hmm.
So that's very different in terms of the survivability of a patient with body armor versus a civilian gunshot wound where it's a close range gunshot wound and almost an assassin's type mode where the survivability is going to be markedly limited because there's no protective barrier from body armor. And then the other entity which is important is that these are rarely clear, clean type injuries. What I mean by that is that if it's a blast injury, many times it involves a significant disruption of the scalp, of the skull, of the normal anatomic continuity of the skull base. And so what happens is that you're not just dealing with the role for taking the pressure off the brain, but you're dealing with an avulsion of the scalp, a very complex, comminuted fracture of the skull, and many times an injury that basically totally disrupts the anatomic continuity between, in some cases, the anterior skull base, the orbit, the maxilla, or in other cases, the external auditory canal, petrous bone, and the skull base. So the risk for significant CSF leak, problems with meningitis, problems with encephaloceles, problems with neurovascular injuries are quite significant. So overall, I would say that the difference in these patients is that they have a higher associated injury index, an injury severity score. They have more complex wound injury patterns, and the wound injury patterns are zones of injury as opposed to an isolated organ injury, and in those zones, you can have significant issues with loss of scalp, skull, supporting structures, the normal buttresses of the face with loss of the orbital bandeau, zygomatic arches, and the orbit, and that can make reconstruction quite difficult.
Yes, I can imagine, absolutely. The next question that I had for you, sir, was what were some of the more important good and poor prognostic factors in your patient population for this study?
So some of the best prognostic factors in terms of good outcome were patients who basically had an injury that was rapidly decompressed, without associated penetrating fragments that went through the deep core of the brain, without fragments that penetrated the hypothalamus, the thalamus, and the diencephalon, without diffuse subarachnoid air that involved both the supra and infratentorial space. Those patients in which the fragments were localized to one lobe of the brain or, in fact, did not penetrate the deep structures had a much higher prognosis for a better outcome for independence. Those individuals who did not have multiple compartmental injuries, in other words, bilateral or infratentorial, supratentorial, also fared better. Those individuals who did not have significant hypoxia, for example, patients who were not trapped in a vehicle for a prolonged period or not in a submerged injury pattern where they had problems with hypoxia and or hypotension on top of their injury, tended to do better. The patients who showed the greatest improvements were patients who demonstrated localization prior to their decompression. If they showed localization even ipsilateral to the injury, they usually did better. Those patients whose motor exam showed extensor posturing or flexor posturing and had more of a diffuse injury with diffuse subarachnoid air, even with the decompression, those patients had a poor prognosis overall. And so there's a group of patients that when you see on the battlefield, you make a very important assessment on the survivability of this patient. And some of those patients, if they had a pupillary exam, if they're bilaterally dilated in terms of pupillary exam, if they're extensor posturing, and if they have significant fragments in the diencephalon, it may not necessarily be worth doing a decompressive operation.
One final question for you, sir. If you could tell our listeners, what were some of the early and late complications or issues that you had to face with these obviously very complex cases? You alluded to, you know, some of the reconstruction challenges with scalp coverage and the loss of some of the bone in the head and face, but if you could just elaborate on some of these early and late complications, I think our listeners would be very interested in it.
Sure. Some of the problems with early complications after a decompressive craniectomy is that the operation basically is designed to create an increased space. And if, in fact, your decompression was too small, you could get problems with venous infarctions or hemorrhages with associated infarctions because of protruding brain at the edges of your decompression. So early on, we identified the need for ensuring that the decompression is at least 15 centimeters and that we included the middle cranial fossa with removal of the temporal bone. And we used typically a duroplasty with a Durogen, a synthetic dural substitute, to increase the dural compartment. It was very imperative to open up the dura for these patients. In addition, some of the early complications other than the sizing of the decompression was the timing. If there was a delay of patients getting to you because of the operational environment, because of problems, and this was pretty rare, but you can occasionally have a case where because of a sandstorm in Iraq or because of a very complex, hazardous mountain extraction in Afghanistan, patients may not get to you until a prolonged period. If that period is greater than 4 hours, these patients tended to do poorer as well.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the other complications that we saw with patients is that the risk for coagulopathy early on. So early on, if these patients had a significant blood loss with an associated amputation scenario where, in fact, they had a limb injury or multiple limbs injured and had significant blood unit volume transfusions, they could become quite coagulopathic. And where that becomes most noticeable is during the decompressive operation. And it's very important that these patients receive active platelets, that they receive blood products. There has been some extensive use of factor 7 in the battle environment, and recombinant factor 7 has a role, but not by itself. It really needs to be combined with use of active platelets. So if you don't have enough active platelets, then your recombinant factors are not going to be effective.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of some of the delayed complications, what one may term subacute, most of these tended to be problems associated with one of two items, either vascular injuries that were associated with pseudoaneurysms or vascular injuries associated with vasospasm. And this affected the overall group in approximately a third of the total volume of patients. So about a third of the patients had either an associated vascular injury with either vasospasm or pseudoaneurysms. In the pseudoaneurysm category patients, those patients were at risk for delayed hemorrhage that could in fact be fatal. In the vasospasm patients, they were at risk for delayed cerebral ischemia and or infarction. Beyond that period of the first 2 to 3 weeks, the other major problem that these patients had in terms of complications is really that of infections. In fact, over 55% of these patients had an infection of one form or the other, CSF infections, ventriculitis being some of the more lethal infections, usually associated with a CSF leak of the anterior cranial fossa or middle cranial fossa. In terms of systemic infections, infections involving the lungs, infections involving the blood, and infections usually involving Acinetobacter could be quite dangerous because these patients would have significant fever burden, significant problems with multi-organ failure, and become very difficult in terms of oxygenating because of progressive ARDS that would typically develop. The majority of patients with late complications were usually a result of delay in their cranioplasty, and the cranioplasty was typically delayed because these patients were at risk for infection with early cranioplasty. The complications that we saw included that of delayed hydrocephalus, problems with a syndrome of the trephine, where they became much more sensitive to the atmospheric pressure for large decompressive areas of the skull, where in fact atmospheric pressure was exerted onto the brain. And the other problem with this group of patients was also problems with the reconstruction itself because of the complexities of the associated scalp injury and or the skull base injury with loss of the orbital bando and problems with separating the anterior cranial fossa from the orbits.
Mm-hmm.
So that pretty much summarizes the major complications in patients from sort of the immediate early subacute and late period.
Great. Well, I would very much like to thank you, Dr. Armanda, for taking the time to answer these questions. And we would like to encourage the listeners to read Dr. Armanda's paper and the many others that are part of our series, Military Neurosurgery Past and Present.
This concludes our podcast. Please join us in June 2010 for a discussion on dynamic stabilization. For information on how to submit your research or to view upcoming topics, please visit thejns.org and click on Call for Papers under the Neurosurgical Focus icon. You can send comments to jnspodcast@thejns.org, and you can also follow us on Twitter.